It is June 5th, 2009. My name is Steve Miller. I'm the host of Book Artists and Poets. And I'm sitting with Peter Verheyen in this little conference room after a heck of a rainy little walk in Philadelphia at the Hybrid Book Conference. Peter, hello.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
It's
pleasure
great.
To finally meet
it's
you.
It's great to meet you after many, many years of knowing you
almost
online.
20.
It's cool. Peter is currently the head of preservation and conservation at Syracuse University Library. And how long have you been doing that?
I've been as head of the department, that's a year now, but I've been at Syracuse with the one-year interruption since 1995.
Mm-hmm.
My job is managing the library's preservation and conservation activities, so special collections, conservation, which is a lab that I set up when I first came there in 1995. I'd like to think of it as the ultimate work-study job, because at the same time, I was getting my library degree on remitted tuition, so it kind of worked the other way. We also do circulating collections repair. And starting in a few weeks, we'll be doing audio preservation. We have one of the biggest collections of wax cylinders in the country, if not the world, and also 78s at Syracuse.
How cool. So are you right in the middle of all that?
I will be. I inherit a position that's an audio engineer who does a lot of this recording, so I'll be looking at what he's doing. At the same time, I'll be making sure that my book repair staff are up to speed and the work-study students are happy too and the conservators happy. And remember that I'm not a bench conservator anymore.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's so cool when you go to these conferences of the book is the emerging stronger and stronger role of libraries and librarians and people who take care of these archives in the world of book arts. I love hearing what happens in the trenches, in the libraries, in terms of books and other objects, so that they have longer lives.
Well, I think it's also a lot of cross-fertilization, because a lot of practicing book artists come to it from the conservation field.
Mm-hmm.
Others, like Hedy, come from being artists to working as conservators. You know, we're exposed to the structures. You know, what better way to learn the structure of a book than when you have something that's totally falling apart in front of you and you have to reconstruct it? So there's a lot of cross-fertilization, which I think makes it very interesting.
Peter Verheyen has a day job, right? I mean, this is your job. You love it.
This pays the bills, yes.
It pays the bills, and you're passionate about it. And I'm going to brag on you a little bit right now, Peter. Peter is one of the most significant figures, I think, in contemporary book arts because of a couple of things that you have created. You created Book Owl,
the
online distribution list that people contribute to in a daily way, and that has by itself created a huge community of people sharing information across continents about book arts. How many people?
It's shy of 3,000 at this point.
3,000 people in a daily way look at what's happening on Book Arts Owl. People connect with people. People connect with events, institutions. It's a pretty astonishing thing. How did that happen, Peter?
Well,
and you do this in a daily way. You monitor.
Well,
you tweak it.
Yeah, the list kind of runs itself unless people start to misbehave. And that's when I send out kind of cheerful messages to the effect of, don't make me come back there. Kind of reminiscent of parents coming back and, you know, to the backseat when the kids are fighting. It started in 1994. I like to joke that, I invented the internet, not Al Gore. But at that time, there was a conservation distribution list run by Walter Henry at Stanford. And there were some book arts topics that would come up, more general binding topics that he never felt, maybe he did, like they really belong, but it was the only medium and it was still very, very nascent. And I had lived in Chicago. Chicago at that time had a very vibrant book arts community. Chicago Hand Bookbinders was going strong. I'm a traditional binder. Chicago Hand Bookbinders had a lot of traditional binders in it. There was a sense of community. I moved to New Haven to work at Yale. East Hampton, Northampton were 45 minutes up the road. Boston was a couple hours. New York was a couple hours. And there was community there. There were people you could interact with. It was no big deal to hop in the car and say, "Hey, Carol, I'm coming up. I want to see you, Claudia, and Sarah, and whoever else is at One Cottage Street. And what are you guys doing? Let's go out and have lunch." And it would be fun. I moved to Cornell and found myself centrally isolated, and very quickly discovered that it was fairly lonely for that kind of interaction. And Walter said, "Well, you're at a university. They got these things called servers, and see if you can start a listserv." So I contacted our computing folks, and they said, "Sure, you can do it. It's free, and have go." And got it started, announced it on a rare books list, announced it on the conservation disc list. And those were basically the only two. There's also the letterpress list, I believe, at that time already, ways to announce something like that. And within, I'd say, the space of about 2 months, I already had 400 people signed up. And the discussions really started going. What for me was kind of a, I don't want to call it a personal section, but kind of this way to make friends in Web 2.0 speak, really just grew to include very quickly representatives from just about every continent.
At times, I've been ticked off by some of the conversations, but almost all the time, it helps me feel like I'm part of a larger community. And I know that there are some hot button issues that hit the fan every now and again. I mean, I suppose that's irritating, but it's also exciting, probably.
It depends on the conversation. If we're arguing about what is an artist's book or what is a book, to take it even to a more basic form, absolutely. If it gets into some of the more personal, visceral issues, it becomes very annoying very quickly, for the most part, because for every post that makes it to the list, I get at least 10 from both sides of the argument in my personal email folder asking me to take action one way or another and to remember that I am somebody's friend. And I very quickly, that's when I clamp down and institute cooling off periods. I've been asked, how can I do that? Who allows me to do that? And the basic reality is that I own the list, I am responsible for it. If there are things that go across the list that will reflect poorly on my employer, that can cause problems for me. They can shut down the list. They don't need permission to do that. This is a benefit. If there are things that end up in archives, the archive of a list is at Stanford. It's part of the big Conservation Online site. I have to deal with Walter Henry, and we have to figure out how do we take things out of the archive or at least make them invisible without compromising it. And that is happening increasingly regular, where it can be everything from, yeah, 5 years ago I made some postings and that was in my blue phase, and I'm not in blue anymore, I'm more in mauve. And can you just get rid of everything before then? And because they don't want it to reflect on them, and the answer there is quite simply, no, I won't. You are aware that when you subscribe that everything goes in the archive and you need to deal with it. But there are other things where legal action has been taken or suggested, where I get in touch with Walter and Walter gets in touch with the counsel or whoever it is at the library, university at Stanford there. And they say, yeah, this could cause problems for us and we don't want to litigate over it and take it out. So that makes things a little less enjoyable at times. But that's the nature of our society.
Can you remember the first time where something really fired up?
Not really. I think probably one of the first really lively discussions we actually had was about what is a book. And I think that might have been me being bored by the discussions that were going on at that point and deciding to throw a match in the gasoline. Some of those have been really, really good. I mean, one of them, if you printed it out, would be 80 plus pages. 80 plus pages of good dialogue between established book artists, teachers, students in graduate programs, to people who want to make books because they want to do it with their kids. And it's really the whole spectrum of people who are involved and interested in the book arts that feel that they can contribute, and they do, and it's great.
One thing I love about it is how the community tends to enfold, put its wings around newbies.
Yeah, it does that, and I think that's good. I think one of the things that I sometimes lament, and you know, you talk about hot button issues, one of the ones that we've had very infrequently, and certainly not in the past few years, goes around this idea of elitism. That's almost always equated with being exclusionary. And one of the things that I'm very interested in is expressing the craft at the higher technical levels and aesthetic levels. That in and of itself doesn't have to be exclusionary, but sometimes that is interpreted as that. Things I'm less interested in are questions that come up, and they're perfectly legitimate in the context of the list, but yeah, what's the best spray adhesive or rubber cement to use for making books with wrapping paper? I kind of cringe and I'll delete, but I'm not necessarily going to judge those people. I might off-list to myself, but certainly not on the list. Every person that starts out like that might really grow in the field, discover other interests, really make the effort to learn the crafts that are part of this field, and become top-notch. And you know, everybody starts out somewhere.
Do you have any observations about how the book arts community has changed in the time that you've moderated the list?
I think it's changed a great deal, but not so much recently. When was it? It was in 1998. I was actually asked to speak on this at the Silver Buckle Press's 20th anniversary or their 25th. The list had been going for about 5 years, so I was kind of looking back at 5 years. I think it's made the book arts much, much more accessible. And it's not just the list, it's also the website. And then that website links to just about everything. You know, if you're looking for something and you know, you do a Google search, you'll either end up at the Book Arts Web, which is the website I started in 95, or at some other site, but we're all so interconnected that you can find out information on just about any workshop, any exhibit, anywhere in the world fairly easily. What it has done, in addition to making the book arts much more accessible to people outside, I mean, we don't have guilds in this country in the traditional sense that regulate the trades and what you need to learn, have examinations. We have MFA programs, we have North Bennett Street School that provide formalized instruction in many cases at very high levels. I mean, that's reaches a fairly small number of people. I mean, you look at the enrollment in the North Bennett Street School, it's maybe 6 or 7 students a year. Granted, that adds up, but there aren't that many programs, so it's a fairly small self-selected group.
Right.
But there's a lot of people who want to make books for whatever reason. They're Society for Creative Anachronism people, and they all need a girdle book. And Pamela Spitzmuller is the queen of girdle books. And people take her workshop, they write it up, or they describe it, and people can find each other. I think what it has changed, other than making the field much more visible, in many respects, it's taken something away from the more formal organizations that used to publish newsletters and still do, in that the information, very often, especially for the newsletters, the information that they have, unless it's, you know, how-tos or things that are fairly unique, the calendars, the listings of workshops, exhibits, they're almost outdated before they come out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really changed where people look first, you know, and that's the online component. The web and the internet, I mean, they've really, we're talking about 15 years now that we've been living with it. I mean, it's really changed that whole paradigm of information seeking.
Did you ever miss print culture in that way?
Absolutely not. I value print culture. I consider myself a part of it. But, you know, let's be honest. If Gutenberg had access to the internet for some of his things, you know, movable type, he might have found out about it sooner than he did. He might have figured out that the Chinese had already been doing it. Who knows? Because they might have been online too. At Syracuse, one of our collections, there's a social reformer from the 19th century. He was an abolitionist. He was into suffrage. all sorts of things, and he would print out all sorts of letters to the editor, letters, pamphlets. If he had been alive 15 years ago, he would have taken full advantage of it. And it really depends on who you're trying to reach for what purpose. Hmm. Printing out something and tacking it to a tree, you know, it doesn't matter, really. I mean, what you're looking for on a base level is the information. Hmm. And this is a way to really share it with a huge, unimaginable audience in many cases. Because it's not just, let's say, the shy of 3,000 people that are subscribed to the list, but it's the people who look at the archive, which they find by, you know, doing Google searches. There's other lists and discussion boards out there as well. In many respects, I've been hoping for several years now that one of them might make it big, and I could gracefully say, okay, this model is antiquated, let's go here. That hasn't happened yet, much to my annoyance. When I brought the Guild of Book Workers online in, I think it was, I don't know, 96 or something, I'd kind of hoped that the guild list would cater to my more elitist proclivities. That hasn't happened. The guild list is effectively dead, with the exception of a few things every now and then. The software that runs Listserv, the interface, it's text only, no images. People gripe about it. I don't blame them. It's antiquated. But there's nothing that's come along that's replaced it yet. So must still be okay.
A lot of this, I think, probably a lot of your passion for this is rooted in the work you've done in the past at the bench.
Yeah. I mean, it's my background. I mean, I did a traditional apprenticeship in hand bookbinding in Germany. After having been infected, encouraged by John Dean, who was head of conservation at Johns Hopkins, who was trained in the traditional English apprenticeship system, I was a work study student. He saw that I was interested. There was another classmate of mine who was also working in the lab. We were both interested, and he encouraged us to, you know, sit in on workshops or watch, volunteer per se, or, you know, in our free time if we wanted to. And that was really great. But I'm very much rooted in the traditional craft aspects of things. I don't necessarily see that changing. Although through friendships with people like Karen Hanmer and others, I've, I think, also really developed an appreciation of the artist book. But I still look at it first from a craft aspect. If you were to hand me an artist book, however we choose to define that, the first thing I would be looking at is, what are the proportions between the boards and the text block? What's the sewing like? Mm-hmm. How does it speak to me? To the annoyance of some of my colleagues at Syracuse, I'm not a conceptual person, so that sometimes makes it difficult for me to communicate with faculty in the art department, for whom I may or may not be this curmudgeonly craft guy, but that's okay.
What would you say to the idea that floats out in the world that as people dive more and more into the digital world, into the computer screens, and spend more and more of their time doing this, that there is a real uptick, as a result, an uptick in interest in things made by hand?
I absolutely agree with that. It's helped me meet a lot of really neat people, even if we've never met face-to-face, but because of my, I'll call it, level of exposure. I have the list, there's the subscriber base, there's other people who find me. I get emails fairly regularly, not a huge amount, but fairly regularly, from people who want to know how to get into the book arts. They're computer programmers, office workers, what have you, and they're looking for something more tangible to do. I encourage them to, you know, if that's what they want to do, to follow it. I will suggest, depending on where they are, people that they might want to talk to. Even if the initial question is more on the vague side, I'm willing to have that dialogue and kind of draw a little bit more out of them, like, well, what are you really looking for? Where are you? Are you mobile? If you really want to learn traditional hand binding, the best option here is North Bennett Street. If you're not in Boston, could you move there? Or are you saddled with, you know, big mortgage, five kids, and, you know, all that stuff, you know, to kind of help them find the best opportunities. But absolutely, there's an increasing number of people wanting to learn these traditional crafts. I do draw the line, that's probably too strong a term though, if people say, I want to make my living at this. talking to friends, colleagues, peers, working in a university library environment, there's not a lot of jobs out there. If somebody wants to make their living at it, whether it's, you know, repairing books for people or something like that, especially on that more practical side, less creative side, you really have to know how to work. There's not a lot of money to be made in it. And I would rather see people get involved in the book arts because they want to and not have to rely on it as their sole source of income. Stick with the day job if it's paying the bills, and, you know, carve out time to make your books, do your printmaking, what have you, instead of maybe, you know, cut out one golf game a month.
Hmm.
You know, do things like that. You know, get involved, join the Guild of Book Workers, go to your regional book art centers, wherever you happen to be. You know, if you want to go, decide you're going to go back to graduate school, look at the programs in Alabama or Utah, kind of. Alabama's probably the most comprehensive. Iowa, I would have sent people to. I don't really know what's going on there. But, you know, look at some of those really good graduate programs where there's top-notch people teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Take advantage of opportunities like PBI, you know, to feed that hunger and see where it takes you. But if you were to say to me, you know, I want to quit my job and I want to do book repair, I would say, yeah, don't do that.
Mm.
And the ability to work, I think, is one of the things that is the hardest to develop. I know some people who are very good, very precise, are very smart, but the work, if you want to be successful, especially paying your bills with it, you have to be able to work quickly. You have to be able to work efficiently in batches, whether you're doing complex treatments or just binding a genealogy for someone. It can't take more than an hour or so to bind a single section pamphlet in a hard case. Otherwise, you know, how are you going to price yourself? There are a lot of people out there who get drawn into making journals, blank books, and they're selling them online. And one of my games is, you know, especially if they identify the materials that they use and you figure out how many pages, figure out how much did their materials cost them.
Mm-hmm.
And then looking at the price and realizing these people are barely recovering their materials, if at all. Why? Why are you doing this? If it's because they just enjoy making them, and as long as they're not losing anything, that's fine. Power to them. You know, but if they're quitting their jobs to do that.
When you are around the physical book, what are some of your favorite materials?
In terms of binding styles, I find myself really drawn to the things that are part of my tradition, which is the German hand binding tradition. I love working with vellum, and I'm not talking limp vellum, I'm talking vellum over boards. For some irrational reason, people are scared witless of it. There are binders out there. I'm not going to name any, but if they listen to this, they'll know who they are, people that I've worked with, who are terrified of it because they're afraid of the boards pulling.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways that that can be controlled. But I just find it an incredibly beautiful material, and it's something that I really, you know, try to encourage people to do. At the end of the day, it's really not much more difficult than doing a cloth binding if you know what you're doing in terms of the structure. I'm really, really drawn to the German, the Bredel paper case bindings or adding leather trim.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. For edition work, most books, for whatever reason, are poetry. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's not so good.
You're rolling your eyes right now, so I'm getting a sense about your feelings about poetry.
Well, some, but, you know, I've seen, you know, they're small volumes. They're delicate volumes.
Mm-hmm.
Why use a 98-point board with a 98-point square back on it when you can take those same 32 pages and use a 40-point, you can round it in the same amount of time that it takes and end up with something really elegant.
Mm-hmm.
I love working with and using paste papers. It's another one of those really almost iconically German decorative techniques on bindings. Leather binding I like to do as well, but it's not something I've done as much of. I think I've done probably more Bredel bindings covered in paper, making use of paste papers that I've created, and vellum bindings and leather bindings, certainly for exhibits.
Hmm.
And I think part of that has to do with the fact that I'm not an artist. I don't consider myself one. I'm a craftsman. That's how I learned it. You know, if I look at a leather binding, at a piece of leather, getting into the tooling, that whole design work, that's where I'm conceptually challenged. You know, how do I make this work? I know what I like, but I'm not going to copy a Bonnet binding or a Wiemeler binding or something. Or even if I try to imitate it in some respect, I don't have that thing that's going to make that binding resonate. Hmm. It'll look like a copy, kind of, sort of, maybe, of this style. With the vellum, you can really let the material speak for itself. With the paste papers, the same kind of thing. I like playing with colors and textures in those.
One of the things that goes on in the book arts is that occasionally a publication will come along the way, like Fine Print did many years ago, that represented the field in issue after issue.
And then Bookways came along and lasted for a few years.
That's right. And then when both of those eventually went down, there was a huge sadness in the book world about not having that particular kind of voice. Well, there are other voices right now. There's Jab, representing a certain way of thinking about book arts. Mm-hmm. Most recently is Bonefolder, your baby, your child. And I have to say, I've watched Bonefolder over some issues. And with each issue, I am more and more impressed with it. And it seems like a really cool model of electronic representation of discourse in book arts. Can you talk a little bit about Bonefolder?
Bonefolder really started out, it was one of those, as a librarian, you get to sit in committee meetings, you have your peer-to-peer lunches, and one of the things in academic publishing that's really growing, in part because print journals are getting very, very expensive, and this has nothing really to do with the arts per se, but is this concept of open access, of publishing your things, making them freely accessible and available, making sure the quality is there. So we're not talking necessarily just about a little newsletter or even a zine, which, you know, is a totally different genre. But this idea of a quality publication made freely accessible at minimal cost. I think the cost is one of the really big things, certainly for libraries. We had one of these presentations, and the woman who was working as a conservator with me at the time, Danya Khan, and I were in this presentation, and she could see that my gears were spinning, and she and I pushed each other's buttons in a lot of good ways. You know, I don't know if it was her looking at me thinking, you know, you want to, or me thinking, you know, could do something like this. But Danya and I continued the dialogue, and there were other people that we talked to, Don Rash, friend and colleague of mine, who's an edition binder, fine binder, Pamela Berrios, who's a conservator at Brigham Young University, Chayla Metzger, who's at the University of Texas at Austin, teaching book conservation, and most recently, Karen Hanmer, who's an artist book person, you know, initially reached out to those people and said, you know, this is what we want to do. What do you think? It's like, yeah, let's do it. Of course, then it's like, okay, how do we do it? Basically, we just decided we were going to do it. You know, we take the issue of reviewing articles fairly seriously. I mean, everybody feels differently about certain articles, but I think by and large, we're succeeding at delivering a quality product, compelling articles from a wide range of book arts related areas. Okay, we're going to do this, and let's see who can get together for the first issue, because you can't, you know, we didn't want to just say, we want to start up this journal. If you have an article that you want to submit for review, send it to us. You know, having been very involved with the Guild of Book Workers, they have a journal that was very good publication, hasn't come out in a while, but they're reworking it, and I think it's going to be great. There was the New Bookbinder, or is the New Bookbinder, the Designer Bookbinders publication. There are others like that. You know, those fairly high standard. Looking at what they offered, knowing about articles that had been submitted to some journals where, for whatever reason, they weren't accepted, but they were still quality articles, we basically pulled together the first issue. Danya and I had written an article on the German style of Springback that got published in the New Bookbinder. Decided, you know, let's do something novel and let's create the Binderamas. And we'll have this unjuried online exhibition. It will exist, you know, only as part of the Bone Folder, do a thematic, and let's say the Springback is our first style. So we had articles, some how-tos. We had some articles on teaching in the book arts, you know, really setting the tone. Longer articles, shorter articles, review, and then this Binderama. The response was terrific. Even after that first issue, people started sending us things. It's grown from there. And one of the things, being the librarian that I guess I am now, you learn about different initiatives. One of those is the Directory of Open Access Journals that's out of Sweden, but a very international thing. Got ourselves listed in there. All of a sudden, the Bone Folder appears in just about every library's catalog, online catalog. If you type in book arts or something, there we are. The audience for this instantly was worldwide. I mean, these were things that we almost, the Open Access, Directory of Open Access Journals was something that came out, we were in after our first issue, but you know, you add the back content and you're there. Making sure that the content is preserved into the future, there's the LOX program, lots of copies keep stuff safe based on redundancy. Because of a work study student that had worked for us in the conservation lab who was working as a technician at NYU, they were participants and he suggested it to them. They looked at it and made it part of their contribution to what was called the Humanities Project. So our content is archived. Even if I were to cease publication now and shut down my server for the Bone Folder, it would continue to exist, at least those back issues, because that is something that is important to me, is that longevity.
Sure.
If I have a print publication like Fine Press or Bookways, Bookways especially, was beautifully printed, those are keepers. You refer to those. You look at, you know, the new book binder. Those are keepers. If I pull something offline, it's gone, unless somebody has printed out those copies. So it's much more ephemeral.
Right.
And so just trying to make sure that it lives on. And most recently, I was able to convince some of my colleagues at Syracuse that we might want to host this on our servers for our digital collections there. They're interested in building a repository, getting faculty papers and things like this. I figured there's a connection. We're not faculty, but Syracuse has definitely played a role. Why not? And they said, sure. So that way, that content will be preserved and made accessible that way. And more importantly, and it was completely self-serving on my part, is it relieves a huge burden on me and my ISP, because I get, you know, 20 gigabytes of bandwidth a month. And when the last issue came out this spring, I got almost to 80 gigabytes of bandwidth within the space of a few days. So
I downloaded it immediately.
Right. And, you know, at, let's call it 8 megabytes an issue, if you have, within days of that last issue, we had almost 4,000 downloads. 8 times 4,000, that's a chunk of change. Plus back issues, because people look at the current issue, it's like, oh, I didn't download that, or, oh, there's an article in that, so I'll download it because I don't want to save, print them out or something. So it gets looked at a lot.
How many issues have gone out so far?
We've done 10. 10 issues, twice a year for the past 5 years.
Is this wearing you out?
No, not really. I mean, sometimes it does, but it has more to do just with organizational issues. I mean, you're working as part of a team, and we very much are a team. Everybody works at a different pace, and you know, the issues come out. It falls to me, by default, and because I enjoy doing it, to lay out the issue and do all the production end of things. So then I get to do that too. So I sometimes hold back more from the critical discussions and focus on the production end of things. But we're fairly democratic about it. I think the system is working really well.
Congratulations on this. And I hope it has a very, very long lifespan.
Well, if the list and the website are any indication, I've got at least 10 years to go.
Peter, how do people get a hold of your operations here? How do people become members of Book Arts L, for instance?
If you go to the Book Arts website, that's philobiblon.com. philobiblon, and there's a story to that name, .com. You know, subscription is right there. It's automated. Everybody's welcome to subscribe to it and hopefully contribute.
Peter Verheyen, I am so grateful meeting you for the first time, although we've known each other for a long time.
Yes.
And you're talking about really what is the massive community building operations that you are behind. And I appreciate it as a maker greatly.
Thank you.
I'll sing you to sleep.
I'll sing you to sleep.
I'll sing you.